This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
I'm Sharmila Ganesan, and welcome to History on Repeat on The Bigger Picture, the 8-part mini-series where we discuss key subjects, places and themes in Malaysia's past and why they continue to matter today. So in today's episode, we'll be speaking about the histories of two important communities in Malaysia, the Chinese and the Indian diasporas. With multi-layered migration over the centuries, migrants from these two parts of the world have profoundly shaped our history. And to guide us through this, we have on today's show Karen M. Teo, Associate Professor of History at Stonehill College, and Sunil Amrit, Mehra Family Professor of South Asian History at Harvard University. So in the first part of today's segment, we'll begin by speaking about Chinese migration with Professor Karen. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for taking the time all the way from the US to do this via Skype with us.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm from Malaysia, so this is really a connecting to home.
So let's start by speaking about, I guess, the natural starting point, right? The precursors to the 19th and 20th century migration of Chinese people to Malaya. What are the earliest records of Chinese presence we have in maritime Southeast Asia? And what can we learn about this from the people who came to Malaya from China?
Sure. Well, before the 19th and 20th century, I'd say the earliest Chinese settlements in Malaya were most commonly traced to the time of the Malaccan Sultanate. So we're talking about the 15th century. And Malacca at this time was a vibrant port city. It was known as the Venice of Asia. So it attracted traders from all over, from India, from the Middle East, China, of course, and throughout Southeast Asia. And some of these Chinese traders didn't simply come and go with the ships. Some stayed on and formed a small but influential local community. So really, this is the first documented instance we have, I would say, of a Chinese community in what is today Malaysia.
Would that be what we now know as the Peranakan community?
Yes. So it would be from this community of primarily male Chinese traders that we have this heritage of the Peranakan. So some of these male Chinese merchants stayed on and, in fact, intermarried with local Malay women from the region. And they produced this hybrid culture and hybrid population of the Peranakans, or later called the Straits Chinese, because they were mostly concentrated in the Straits settlements of Malacca, Penang, and Singapore. And so they kind of fused Chinese as well as local Malay traditions, customs, religions, language. It's a very rich and very complex history that they have.
And then, you know, that sort of brings us to, I suppose, the next large wave of migration. Why was there such a dramatic increase of the migration of Chinese individuals, you know, not just Malaya, but globally when it came to the 19th century?
Yes. Well, when thinking about Chinese migration, I guess this is a little bit of a cliche, but I'm not sure we've come up with a better way to describe it. Typically, historians of migration talk about push and pull factors. And broadly speaking, we can still divide the factors up this way. So in the 19th century, especially, pushing individuals out of their homelands in China were, in short, difficult or just untenable living conditions. Poverty, a great deal of suffering caused by existing trends such as overpopulation or natural disasters, and then economic crises that were brought on by more immediate impacts, the political instability. So specifically, you have the Opium Wars of the 1840s and the 1850s and domestic rebellions in China taking place towards the later half of the 19th century. All of these things combined to make the situation very chaotic, very unstable, and sometimes sometimes just downright dangerous or untenable, especially for the rural poor. So those were the factors pushing people out of their homes to seek a better livelihood elsewhere. Then we talk about the pull factors, or things that made places like Malaya and other areas in Southeast Asia or other parts of the world attractive to migrants who are looking for a better living. So their movement was primarily based on seeking out economic opportunity and relative political stability. So in Malaya, you had, besides the pre-existing trade relations, which we already talked about from the 15th century, right? So they knew that this was a place that people went to do business. It's possible to get there. But now with British colonization, there were these new and growing port cities. And there was rural development, there was agricultural development by the British colonizers. So there was an increasing demand not only for Chinese traders, but also for workers. And migrant Chinese were able to step into this gap.
And so in terms of what about Malaya itself, what did that sort of, that large-scale migration, how did that impact the communities here?
Oh, that's a pretty long-ranging question. Mm-hmm. I guess, one way to think about it is to kind of divide it up into time periods, the shorter, more immediate impact, and then the longer term. Just in terms of the more immediate impact, I suppose you would see this influx of Chinese workers into, as I mentioned before, the port cities, the urban port settlements. So from the late 18th into the 19th century, as these port settlements got larger, and as I mentioned, they had these pull factors, jobs and openings and such, attracting these Chinese workers in there, you had this influx. But you also had Chinese... how do you say, these sort of captains of enterprise, if you will, wealthier merchants who had the money and the means, who had established themselves, and they were able to move into the interior. They were able to, for example, sign contracts or make agreements with the British as well as local Malay rulers and basically open up mines and plantations in the rural hinterlands. So besides the urban areas, you also have the presence of Chinese entrepreneurs, if you will, in the agricultural hinterlands, in Singapore and then later in Johor. And they opened up gold mines, tin mines. They had pepper plantations. So really, you begin to see the presence of the Chinese in different kinds of economic niches in many different places. I think that's not always as well understood, because people typically think of, oh, the Chinese show up, the coolies with the queues down there, running the long hair in the back, and they just come off the ships and they do the hard labor. But really, you had this Chinese presence at many different levels of society, different migrant generations, and playing different kinds of economic roles.
And how big a role did the British Empire play in stimulating this Chinese migration to Malaya?
Oh, quite large. I mean, it's from the Malayan side, clearly the presence of the British, their development of the urban areas, and then also expanding into the agricultural realm, because they wanted to get in on the spice trade. They wanted to compete with the Dutch. So they were actually the ones who encouraged the Chinese who, get into these agreements with the Malay rulers to set up these plantations and so on. The British really facilitated and encouraged a lot of this Chinese enterprise. And of course, the British were profiting as well, because they used the Chinese as workers as well as middlemen for their own trade. So as far as establishing an amenable environment for Chinese migration in Malaya, they played a large role. And I suppose if you really want to be complete about it, you could look at the sending end in China and say, well, thanks to the British and their opium war in China, which effectively upended political and economic stability in their homeland, they were also responsible from the sending end for creating a lot of those conditions too.
Why was there a predominance of migration from southern China in particular?
Yes, so definitely there was that pattern. And, the most obvious answer perhaps is just geographic proximity. Mm-hmm. You know, the southeastern provinces of Fujian and Guangdong are the geographically closest to island Southeast Asia. But there are other factors also that definitely, you know, strengthened that trend. Part of it is that the Qing Dynasty, the rulers of China at this time, in fact, did not approve of emigration out of their country. They did not make it legal. They did not make it easy, even though there was a lot of hardship. And this was clearly one of the ways for poor people to, you know, find a living was to leave the country to make money. And so arguably, communities that lived far from the political center in the north in Beijing, so basically these people in the far southeast of the country, especially near the coastal regions, they would have an easier time, you know, escaping the scrutiny of officialdom, and especially if they had a tradition already of seafaring and of doing business, of sailing to Southeast Asia to trade, if that was already part of their history and their tradition, then that might also have facilitated their movement.
And how much choice did these individuals have in deciding to migrate? Or agency, I suppose, would be the other way to ask.
Yeah, I guess there are a couple of ways of thinking of that. You know, maybe thinking about what options they had, you know, besides migration. Again, I think for the rural poor, if they didn't have the skills or opportunity or the money to try and find a living in any kind of urban or non-agricultural environment, and if the living was, you know, so bad, options were so stark or so few, then really emigration out of the country, given that the country was in some disarray, may have been their best choice. Perhaps another way of thinking about it too is how they would emigrate. And there you do see some differentiation in terms of the options people had in how they would try to emigrate from the country. Those who could do so voluntarily and who had the kinship connections, perhaps. So there's a kind of kinship-based migration where initial immigrants, Chinese immigrants already in Malaya, let's say, had established themselves, had set up a business, or who had, you know, made some money and had the means, would then recruit from their kinsmen or their relatives back in their home villages or home regions. So those people might have the opportunity to say, oh, hey, you know, uncle so-and-so or, you know, this cousin can sponsor me. And when I go there, I know I'll have a job and they'll help pay my way. So that was perhaps a more favorable kind of migration. And then those who were less fortunate, who didn't have the money, didn't have any connections, would basically have to go into debt to labor brokers, migrant brokers, who would say, okay, you know, fine, I'll help you get from here to, you know, Johor or to Penang or wherever. But once you get there, you work wherever I tell you to work, and your wages have to come to me to pay back the debt for your passage. So that was still voluntary, I suppose, but that was called the credit ticket system, and that could definitely be abused and, you know, remove a lot of agency and choice from people in terms of where they would work and maybe even how long they'd end up in debt.
Now, when we talk about migration, we often tend to imagine men. But I'm actually curious also to know about how the women's experience, the Chinese women's experience of migrating to Malaya was, and how did this differ from the men?
Oh, sure. Quite a lot, I guess, is the quick answer. Yeah. Yes, you're correct. I think typically when people think of Chinese migration, whether it's to Malaya or other parts of the world, people often think of so-called bachelor societies. And this is true in the sense that not until the first half of the 20th century really did Chinese women migrate, or did Chinese female immigrants reach the same numbers as Chinese male immigrants in the country. You know, a lot of this could be attributed to patriarchal norms in China, in Chinese society, for centuries, really. These patriarchal norms meant that men would be the ones to leave home to work and to earn money and send it back home. So they were the ones working outside, whereas women would take care of the domestic sphere. So women would often stay home to care for the house, the children, elderly parents, etc. So to the extent that women did migrate, it was first of all very small numbers. And secondly, those who did tended to be relatively unusual in terms of their social roles. Either they were fortunate to be wives or daughters of merchants who could afford to bring their families with them. Then that was a small minority. Or there have been records of Chinese girls and women who were either enticed or abducted, basically kidnapped, and then, you know, compelled to be in sexual servitude, to basically be forced into prostitution or into domestic servitude. You know, obviously, because this was an illegal trade, we don't have really good numbers for that. You know, the British kept certain records. The British were, you know, pretty obsessed with trying to enforce physical as well as moral hygiene. So they kept track of this and they tried to enact legislation to protect Chinese girls and women. But again, what numbers we do have suggest a pretty small minority.
So I suppose that would then beg the natural question of how did this community then, you know, sort of propagate and have children and go on to establish roots here if there were so few women?
Absolutely. So that's one factor that makes us think that there may have been migration taking place in ways that have not been tracked as well officially, or that there has been a lot of undue and, you know, unflattering attention paid to this segment of history, which is definitely true. There were girls and women who were forced into these kinds of servitude, and, you know, a lot has been written and documented about them. But because we have this focus on these unusual segments of society, we've paid less attention to the women who did come and who did, let's say, you know, were married and, you know, lived in families, were mothers, daughters, sisters, etc. So basically, over time, the number of women migrating did increase gradually. Then, of course, you have to factor in the Peranakan population. You have to factor in that intermarriage was a complex thing, such that, for example, over time, male descendants in Peranakan families actually decided that they wanted to marry Chinese women from China in some cases. And so they would actually have arranged marriages and bring over wives from China, and then they would have families and children and so on. So in other words, the demographic development is fairly complicated, not always as straightforward as people think. And of course, as there were more generations of these families, people settling here, there were more girls and women born and bred in Malaya, and therefore the community, local community, did increase.
So how did the reasons for migration from China to Malaya shift or change over the course of the 20th century?
In the 20th century, the reasons as well as the levels of migration changed quite dramatically. Really, you were talking about this wave of migration in the 19th century, and it does kind of crest from the 1870s until the 1920s. And then arguably, this sort of age of mass migration within Asia drops off quite severely, and really doesn't, you know, regain until the late 20th century. So in the 1920s, there was a pretty severe economic depression worldwide. And this economic crisis meant a lot of workers lost their jobs. Either migrants were no longer able or willing to come, or some were in fact repatriated. They were sent home. So that actually changed the migrant trend. Then in the 1930s, basically you had warfare and displacement on a huge scale. As we know, World War II in China started in the 1930s, not in the 1940s. So Japanese occupation, World War II killed and displaced millions of people. It created refugee populations, to be sure, but it also broke down local economies and networks for migration. So that was another thing that kind of weakened migration. And then in the 1940s to the 1960s, then you have another whole political movement with decolonization, with the British moving out of India and then eventually leaving Malaya, Southeast Asia, and so forth, and the 1949 Communist Revolution in China. So you basically have all these nationalisms popping up everywhere and decolonization happening at the same time. So nation states are fracturing and rebuilding. Again, people are displaced. So there is some movement of people, but definitely the movement of Chinese from China to Malaya and to Singapore kind of drop off around this point.
Mm. And overall, when we compare, how did the Chinese experience of migration compare to the other major migrant group that we have in Malaysia today, the Indians or the South Asians?
At a minimum, I suppose one can make a pretty broad generalization, you know, one that we haven't really touched on so far. We haven't talked about sojourning, this idea that migration isn't just a one-way journey, that oftentimes people would move from point A to point B, and then sometimes from point B back to point A. Sometimes they would do it repeatedly. Sometimes from point B, they'd go to point C. So migration is, in fact, a multi-stop and sometimes a circulatory movement. And I think as historians have looked more closely at both the migrant Chinese and the migrant South Asian populations, they've realized that both the Chinese and South Asian peoples, especially from the 19th to the 20th century, that there was a lot more of this sojourning and circulation as a pattern in Asia, as opposed to, let's say, European migration from Europe to, let's say, North America in the 16th and 17th centuries. So this is a pretty distinct pattern. It's in Asia, it's in a certain time period, and it took place under the auspices of European empire. So that's an interesting commonality, I think, that that historians of migration have really noticed.
Mm. And thinking more broadly, why are the Chinese communities of Malaysia significant in Malaysian history? What impact have they had over time, and what impact do they continue to have today?
I think there are kind of two ways to answer that question. One, I think, is fairly well addressed in that historians in Malaysia and elsewhere have talked about Chinese contributions in, you know, all the different spheres, economic, political, sociocultural, right, ranging from the very earliest days of trade, enterprise, plantation, agriculture, infrastructure building. There's all of that. And then society building, social institutions, the development of schools, hospitals. There's cultural productivity, arts, fine arts, literature, and everything. So there's kind of that whole sphere. And then on the other side, there's also a more kind of thematic, more abstract approach, which is to think about migration as a whole. And I think as a historian, to my mind, when I think about the ethnic Chinese, as well as the ethnic South Asians and ethnic Malays and all the different groups that make up Malaysian society, it really is a reminder of how fluid and flexible and multi-layered Southeast Asian culture and society has been, not just over the past 100 or 200 years, but for hundreds of years, that this has been the nature of Southeast Asian society. And I think, too, there's this idea of how the margins make the mainstream, as I like to say, which is that there's a constant effort to achieve better inclusiveness and interracial relationships in this multicultural society, right? Mm-hmm. Driven as a result of in-migration by the Chinese and Indians and other groups. Mm-hmm. And this actually, I think, often pushes a society towards a greater degree of democracy and equity. In a way, right, the presence of people on the margins trying to push into the mainstream kind of creates a productive tension. So I think that's this second aspect perhaps is less talked about, but I think it's an important contribution of the presence of, you know, the Chinese and other migrant communities in Malaysia.
Karen, you know, this is a conversation that could go on for much longer, but I'm afraid we are running out of time. But thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us. And thank you for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Shamila, for having me.
So we do need to take a quick break, but you're listening to History on Repeat, where we discuss key subjects, places and themes in Malaysia's past and why they matter today. Today, we're hearing from experts on Chinese and Indian migration to Malaysia. We just spoke to Karen M. Teo, Associate Professor of History at Stonehill College, about the history of Chinese migrations. And when we come back, I'll be handing over the reins to my colleague, T. Xiaoik, who spoke with Sunil Amrit, Mehra Family Professor of South Asian History at Harvard University, about the Indian migration to Malaysia. We'll be back after a short break on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to History on Repeat, where we discuss key subjects, places and themes in Malaysia's past and why they matter today. In the first part of today's show, I spoke with Karen M. Teo, Associate Professor of History at Stonehill College, about the history of Chinese migration to Malaysia. Now, we'll be hearing from my colleague T. Xiaoik, who spoke with Sunil Amrit, Mehra Family Professor of South Asian History at Harvard University, to learn more about the Indian and Sri Lankan migrations to Malaysia.
Professor Sunil, to begin, I'd like to think back as far as we can. What kinds of early evidence do we have of individuals from South Asia visiting or living in the area that, you know, we now call Malaysia today?
The sort of the ancientness of that presence actually first struck me when I visited Lembah Bujang for the first time. And I think there are, that is the largest archaeological site in Malaysia, which testifies to, you know, the centuries old presence of, in this case, South Asian Hindu communities. But I think you see fragments all over the peninsula, but also more broadly in Southeast Asia, of a very, very long-standing cultural and commercial contact between South and Southeast Asia. And you see it also, of course, in, you know, very famous monuments like Borobudur and the transmission, the circulation of Hindu-Buddhist cultures across Southeast Asia in a much earlier era.
Okay. And, then we look a little bit further ahead to the 18th and 19th centuries, which of course saw colonization of large areas of India and Sri Lanka. How did that period, what kinds of movement of South Asians did we see in that period to Malaya?
That is the moment of British colonization, when the movement, which was not new, and I think we just talked about that, the movement is not new, but it is totally transformed in scale. So it is in the 19th century. First, when it comes to movement between India and Sri Lanka, we're talking about the sort of 1840s, 1850s. When it comes to movement to Malaya, a little bit later, sort of 1870s, 1880s, you see a massive, massive growth of migration. And clearly, those migratory routes, in a sense, mirror and follow the routes of British imperial expansion, in particular, from India across the Bay of Bengal into Southeast Asia. And of course, a major driver of that expansion was a quest for the natural resources of Southeast Asia, of the Malay Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And it was the hunger for labor that planters, first in coffee planters, sugar planters, eventually, of course, rubber planters above all, it was their hunger for labor that led them to turn to India as a place from which to recruit labor on a very large scale.
But why India specifically?
That's a very good question. And I think one thing we might want to do is also to put this in a broader global context. One of the key reasons why the British Empire as a whole turns to India for labor is because of the abolition of slavery, which happens in the British Empire. And this leaves the enormously lucrative sugar plantations, not just of the Caribbean and of the Indian Ocean, struggling to find labor because, you know, unsurprisingly, enslaved people who had gained freedom had no wish to continue to work on plantations.
Of course.
And partly because the British had, by this point in the early 19th century, gained a stranglehold over India, partly because of a whole series of assumptions, including, you know, assumptions that we would think of as racist assumptions about the sort of suitability of certain groups of people from India for hard labor. Because also the British managed to channel into, tap into these existing labor recruitment networks in India. For all of those reasons, India becomes one of the major sources of labor for the British Empire worldwide, but especially in Southeast Asia.
Mm. And, you know, I asked about the 18th and 19th centuries, but even within, you know, that very large and vast period, was there an increase seen, let's say, in the 19th century?
Absolutely. So what you see in the 18th century is something which we might think of as a little bit more of a continuity with earlier movements, mm-hmm. Which is to say, when you first start to get South Asians arriving in Penang, for example, after the East India Company establishes a settlement there, mm-hmm. they're relatively small-scale movements which are often following paths which were well-trodden. Very heavily, you see Tamil-speaking Muslim communities, for example, very heavily represented. And these are communities that had for a very long time had a foothold in the port cities of Southeast Asia. And so what happens to totally transform that scale does happen in the 19th century. One of the things that happens is, of course, the Industrial Revolution in Britain, mm-hmm. and the fact that, you know, British factories come to depend more and more on raw materials from across the tropical world. Mm-hmm. Another thing that transforms the scale of migration is new technology. I mean, the steamship is fairly evidently the thing that makes a migration on a massive scale cheaper and faster than it had ever been before. And it's, mm-hmm. I'd say, you know, the second half of the 19th century is when you really see that transition from constant but small-scale migration to mass migration.
Can we get a sense of numbers?
Those are actually very difficult to be precise about, partly because different kinds of sources tell very different stories about numbers. And one place we can turn, and you know, the first place most historians turn when we're trying to think about numbers is to censuses. And you know, census records don't really begin in either India or in Southeast Asia until around the 1870s, 1880s. Mm. The census is, of course, a snapshot of the population at a particular moment in time. It actually doesn't tell us all that much about mobility. Mm-hmm. So on top of that, we can also look at shipping records. You know, some of those are quite detailed for particular moments, especially in particular places. Putting that all together, I mean, the numbers were vast. Mm-hmm. And the most convincing sort of ballpark figure that I'd sort of come to, and this is really drawing on the work of scholars like K.S. Sundu, who were working in the late 1960s, scholars like Adam McEwen, who have given us numbers of global migration, and he was writing the 2000s, there's something like 20 million people made the journey back and forth between India and Malaya. It's difficult to say whether that's unlikely to be 20 million distinct individuals, because these are 20 million journeys. And this is roughly from the period of the 1870s to the 1930s. 20 million journeys might well, in fact, probably did involve the same individuals traveling back and forth many times, because that was, in fact, the pattern of migration. So beyond giving a sense that this is a huge migration comparable with the largest movements of labor in global history, I'm not sort of confident in the specificity of those numbers. The point, I think, is rather a comparative one, which is to say, you know, we know so much about transatlantic migration. We know a reasonable amount about Chinese migration to Southeast Asia. We know much less about South Asian migration to Southeast Asia, and yet it was on a comparable scale.
Mm. And you also have mentioned that it was the Tamil-speaking peoples who made up a large proportion of those coming from South Asia to this region. Why them in particular?
That's a very interesting question, and I think there are a range of different answers to it. One is proximity. Another is, though, if you're saying it's about proximity, then one could ask, well, why were there not more Bengali migrants, for example, who are, you know, not very much further away? They're still on the east coast of India. Some of it is what, you know, economists would call path dependency, which is to say, when migration starts from one place, those networks tend to become self-reproducing. Mm. So to give you an example, it was predominantly Tamil-speaking people who moved to Malaya, but it was predominantly Telugu-speaking people who moved to Burma. Mm-hmm. In exactly the same period of time, it was predominantly Tamil-speaking people who moved to Sri Lanka. There's another kind of explanation we can give, which is to say that actually some of the first planters in Malaya actually came there from Ceylon. These are European planters who had set up plantations in Sri Lanka and then at some point in the 19th century decided to try their luck in Malaya. Mm. They were already used to working with Tamil labor. Mm. And so there's also a sense that, you know, it's the employers, because of familiarity, also perhaps because of a set of stereotypes about Tamil workers being good workers, decided to turn to that part of South India to recruit labor. But once it starts, it sort of keeps going, and in some sense, it keeps going on its own, which is to say that migrant workers went where they knew that others from their village had gone before them. Mm-hmm. They went where the labor recruiters were offering them jobs. And these networks tend to become quite tight to the point that, you know, there's very specific villages in Tamil Nadu which are connected with specific plantations in Malaya. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that level of networking, I think, becomes an important part of the explanation for why people from some villages go and others don't. And one of the striking phenomena, I think, you find this in southern China as well as in South India, is that you might find one village where, you know, half the working age men at any time in the 1870s, 1880s are overseas. Mm-hmm. And the neighboring village may have nobody overseas. And I think a lot of that has to do with the importance of family networks, recruiting networks in these, what Adam McEwen, the historian, used a very nice phrase. I think he calls them grooves of migration. So the idea is they get deeper and deeper as they are trodden.
Mm, yes. And you take the path well traveled.
Indeed. Yes. Indeed. Where you have cousins or other such, you know, family members, uncles, cousins, you know, other known people.
Mm, that's right. And you said men. Would it have been mostly the men who you know, trod these paths?
Yeah, this is a striking feature of this migration, is that it is, until the beginning of the 20th century, overwhelmingly male. I don't have the statistics to hand, but, you know, we are talking about, you know, perhaps one woman for every five, six, even seven men in the early period of mass migration. Mm. That starts to change significantly in the 20th century, and you see a sort of rebalancing of the gender composition of migration. By the 1920s, 1930s, it's a much more mixed group of migrants, and it's with a much better balance between men and women.
But in the early days, it would have been driven by the fact that they were working in plantations.
Yes. And the fact that the migration was almost always seen as temporary. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that has struck me from my research is how few of these labour migrants from India ever intended to settle in Malaya. Again, that changes in the 20th century. But until then, the idea was, I'm going to go for 3 years, for 5 years, 7 years, and I'm going to earn some money and I'm going to go back home. So many people had families at home. They didn't take their families with them. This was seen as a sort of temporary, albeit sometimes fairly long-term temporary migration. And, you know, the same is very, very true of the patterns of Chinese migration to Southeast Asia in that period. This leads to a number of concerns, and those concerns are partly on the part of British colonial officials, but also in India, there are journalists and Indian nationalist political figures who are increasingly concerned about the sort of imbalanced nature of this migration, some of the social consequences that they feel will come from this. And so there's a more concerted effort to recruit women to make the journey to Malaya by the 1920s, 1930s. The one exception to that pattern is actually Sri Lanka. In Sri Lanka, family migration was the norm from a much earlier period, even in the middle of the 19th century. And again, there are, I think, a couple of reasons for that. One, again, is proximity. I mean, Sri Lanka is so very much closer to South India than Malaysia is, that it was more common for family groups to make the journey together. Another reason is that in Sri Lanka, it was mostly tea plantations. And there were more employment opportunities for women and children on tea plantations than there were on rubber plantations. Mm. And that just has to do with the rhythms of work, the kinds of tasks that were demanded of the workers.
Mm. But that idea that demigration would be temporary, was that necessarily the case across the board?
I think it varies. I think if you look at the more elite sector of migrant society, I think there would have been much more of a sense of perhaps making a home in Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. If you look, for example, at Tamil-speaking Muslim traders and merchants, you know, many of them from quite early on intermarried with local families, especially local princely families. They married into the ruling families of many of the port cities in Malaya and in across the Indonesian archipelago. And for them, there was clearly a very much more of a sense of belonging and settlement that came with that mobility. I think for the labor migrants, for the predominantly Hindu labor migrants who came starting in the second half of the 19th century, there was much more of a sense that this was a temporary home, a place of labor and suffering. And let's not forget that element of it, which ultimately many hoped would bring them enough in earnings to perhaps repay their family's debts, possibly. And I think the ultimate goal was always to buy land in rural South India.
Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned suffering, because, of course, we could very easily forget that aspect of it. And you also mentioned, you know, there were recruiters bringing them over. I mean, can you paint a picture of really what the reality was like, and how much choice really did individuals have in deciding to migrate?
This is an ongoing debate among historians now, but in a sense, this has been a debate even since the 19th century. So when the British first brought in the system of indentured labor, which is the system they initially used to take Indian laborers to Malaya, there were humanitarians, even back home in Britain, who said, well, this is just a new system of slavery. Mm-hmm. You know, it's slavery by a different name. And so from that moment on, from the 1830s on, you have, you know, the British colonial elite really sort of twisting, bending over backwards to try to justify indenture as a form of free labor. And the argument was, these are not slaves, they are voluntarily signing a contract that promises to labor for a particular employer for 7 years. After that, they are free. And then the question is, well, what do we really mean by free? Mm-hmm. And one of the very common complaints was that the labor recruiters made false promises to the workers. And you know, in a sense, there's something very familiar about that. If you look at labor migration to the Gulf states today, or even to the construction industry in Malaysia and Singapore, one often hears stories about labor recruiters painting a picture of a land of riches,
opportunities,
quick wealth and opportunity. And the reality is very, very different. And I think there's plenty of evidence that that was the case in the 19th century. I think another way in which we have to question this, you know, how free they really were, is if we think about the importance of debt. Again, in a way that has a lot of contemporary resonance, to migrate was very expensive. And the families of labor migrants often became deeply in debt to these labor recruiters. And that itself was a tool of leverage, not only over the workers, but over their families back home. And I think there are lots of evidence in the archives that debt operates in this way that really limits the choices of labor migrants. Having said that, I think we need to be attentive to the other side of the story, which is to say that when occasionally we do hear the voices of the labor migrants themselves in the archives, and there are various moments at which this happens, very often these are not stories only of suffering, but also stories of ambition. These are stories of self-realization. And I think that that element of it is something that we need not to miss, even as we paint a picture of what was very clearly a deeply exploitative, unjust system.
It is largely complex, isn't it? And, you know, also we can gain more insight by understanding the social and economic roles that South Asian migrants played in Malayan society under British colonial rule. Can you expand a little more on that for us?
I think there are two different places we would look for that. And we've already talked quite a lot about the plantations. And, you know, clearly, you know, to the extent that Malaya's wealth was built on these plantations,
yes,
you can see that the labor and indeed the suffering of South Asian migrant workers was pivotally important to making Malaya what was actually, by the 1930s, 40s, the most lucrative colony in the entire British Empire. But there are other roles that South Asians play too, and there we need to turn our attention, I think, to the urban sphere. And if we look at Singapore and Penang and Kuala Lumpur, but also places like Ipoh, even Alostar, you have the emergence of a class of South Asian professionals, and they were journalists, they were lawyers, they were professionals, doctors from you know, already early in the 20th century. But also a vibrant South Asian working class in the cities. If you look at the history of Singapore's docks, for example, Singapore's harbour, you find very heavily represented different forms of South Asian labour. So I think we need to think about the full spectrum of roles that South Asian migrants played in colonial Malaya, and in that we should also include the Straits settlements, of course. And I think that while plantation labour looms large numerically, the significance is there in many, many other spheres of life as well, including within the colonial administration. I mean, let's not forget how many of the sort of lower level, especially officers of the British colonial administration in Malaya, were of South Asian origin.
Yeah, we do make the mistake today of painting them with that broad brush of, plantation workers and forgetting the nuances as well.
And I mean, I'd say just to add to that, that they were not just Tamil. I mean, again, the Tamil-speaking migrants were numerically predominant, probably 90% or more. But in fact, it's a very diverse South Asian community that ends up in Malaya and in other parts of Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
There's this sort of irony that the term Bengali is actually used to refer to all North Indian migrants at a certain point. But, they were coming from what is now Uttar Pradesh. They were coming from Punjab, of course, in significant numbers as well. There were plenty of Malayali migrants who come from Kerala, from southwestern India, to Malaya. And then you also have the phenomenon of what, in contemporary social science language, we'd call twice migrants or repeat migrants. So what you have is Tamil speakers from Sri Lanka then making a sort of further move to Malaya. And some of them were Jaffna Tamils who had been settled in Sri Lanka for centuries, for several generations. But others were sort of more recent migrants to Sri Lanka who then moved on to Malaya. And I found many stories of that kind where people were not just making a single journey from India to Malaya, but often they were circulating around the entirety of the Eastern Indian Ocean, doing a stint in Burma, a stint in Malaya, perhaps a period back home.
Mm. And what kinds of trends, and you've already brought up the 20th century, the movements in the 20th century, what were the reasons for migration, in that era?
I think the reasons for migration, by the time we get into the 20th century, become more diverse.
Mm-hmm.
Migration becomes a much more channeled along family networks. So by the 1920s, for example, the 1920s are really the peak of migration. By that point, the labor recruiters have lost some of the power that they had in the 1870s and the 1880s. It is much more common for people to find employment in Malaya purely through family networks and, people essentially following their family members across the Bay of Bengal. And with that, I think, you can, if you want to use the term freedom, I think you can see the migration does become somewhat freer by the 1920s, freer of constraint, freer of restriction, not free of debt. I mean, I think the debt relationship remains a characteristic. With urban growth, you see, of course, many new opportunities for migrants in the cities, in new industries that come up in the cities, in Burma, to take a sort of neighboring example, you see an extraordinarily wide range of employments that South Asian migrants go to.
Mm. And how did the South Asian experiences compare to the other, the other major migrant group in Malaya at the time was the Chinese? How did their experiences, differ, were similar, or how did they intersect?
I think there are both similarities and differences. I mean, there's a similarity that simply comes from the scale. I mean, these are of comparable scale. There's a similarity that comes from the fact that it's the same basic economic and political conditions that are creating this demand for migrant labor. You know, it is the process of the expansion of capitalism and empire into this part of the world. There's a very significant difference, which comes from some of what we were talking about earlier. You know, India was colonized by the British. And while the British were increasingly influential in China, they never came close to colonizing it. As such, Chinese migration to Malaysia, I think, was freer of colonial control. Mm-hmm. And one of the simplest ways to sort of illustrate the difference is that most South Asian migrants who came to Malaya went to work for Europeans. They went to work for British planters, mm-hmm. Whereas the overwhelming majority of Chinese migrants to Malaya came on Chinese ships and went to work for Chinese employers.
Yes.
And so there's a much more sort of complex institutional architecture of Chinese society in Malaya by the 19th century, with this sort of native place associations and dialect groups. You don't really see that with the South Asian community to the same extent, not until the 20th century. And one of the reasons, I think, is because the much more dominant role that the colonial state plays in the recruitment and the management and the oversight of South Asian migration.
Mm. And, you know, thinking more broadly now, why are the South Asian communities of Malaysia significant in our history? What impact do they continue to have today?
I think they're an integral part of the social fabric of Malaysia. And I think that is, in and of itself, the most important reason to study them. I think it makes it very important to study the South Asian migrant community in Malaysia in their interactions with others. I mean, they were never isolated. Even on the plantations, there's evidence of many different kinds of interaction between South Asians and other groups. But especially if you look outside the plantation world, I think what's important is to see how early on South Asians become an integral part of a complex society, not an enclosed diasporic community, but rather a sort of community that finds multiple roles for itself. And I think we can find, you know, if we want reasons to study that community in terms of the significance of their contributions, I think we can find it wherever we look. We can find it in their contributions to Malaysia's wealth. We can find it in their contributions to intellectual life. We can find it in their contributions to political life.
Yes.
So I think my caution is that we shouldn't fall into the trap of studying diasporas in a sort of very inward-looking way, because I think one of the things that makes diasporas in Malaysia most interesting is the fact that, you know, Malaysia is the meeting point for multiple diasporas. It is one of the most important sites in the world for the interaction between Chinese and South Asian migrants, for example. It is one of the most important sites for the coming together of multiple Asian cultures, including you know, mobile cultures from across the Indonesian archipelago. And I think we truly see the significance of diaspora in that much more sort of interactive way, I think.
Mm. Thank you so much, Professor Sunil.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
That was so fascinating.
Thank you.
So that was my fellow Bigger Picture resident, Ti Xiao Ik, speaking with Sunil Amrit, Mehra Family Professor of South Asian History at Harvard University, about the history of Indian migration to Malaysia. So this wraps up our segment on the histories of Chinese and Indian diasporic communities here in Malaysia on the sixth episode of History on Repeat. It is an eight-part mini-series where we discuss key subjects, places and themes in Malaysia's past and their relevance today. If you've missed any part of this interview or any previous segments, you can download the podcast on bfm.my, on our BFM app, or on Spotify. You've been listening to History on Repeat on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.